Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today, my guest is Nancy Piercy, author of Total Truth, Saving Leonardo, and Love Thy Body. She is currently professor and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University, as well as a fellow of the Discovery Institute and editor-at-large of the Piercy Report. Over four episodes, I'm speaking with Nancy about a chapter she wrote for a book called Mere Creation, Science, Faith, and Intelligent Design, that was recently highlighted in four parts on the blog More Than Cake. It's called You Guys Lost. Is Design a Closed Issue? Although many may hold that Darwin conquered the design argument over 150 years ago, Nancy shows that there's good reasons for returning to the site of battle and asking whether it was won fair and square. In our first episode, Nancy addressed the question of why Darwin became the focal point of debate in the 19th century, even for many who did not accept his theory. On today's episode, she recounts her examination of the writings of Darwin's core supporters in the 19th century, digging deeper to get to the real story of Darwin's work and the debate still going on today that resulted from it. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you hold that the typical story of how Darwin produced his theory is different from the story professional historians tell. Can you explain that a bit?
Right. We usually do think, as you put it, that what we hear in the media, on in TV science programs, textbooks in schools and so on, we constantly hear that Darwin proved the point scientifically and that he was pressed to his conclusions by the evidence he found, for example, his trip to the Galapagos Islands and so on. But if you look at the history, you'll find that not only Darwin, but also his immediate supporters, for the most part, first became naturalist in their philosophy. That is, they rejected the idea that there could be any kind of divine action in nature. They decided that the only thing that science can consider is natural causes. And only then did they accept any form of evolution? Well, of course they did, because once you accept naturalism, there's no other alternative. And let's start with Darwin himself. In his personal letters, he describes how he gradually lost any sort of religious belief and slid into a kind of naturalistic philosophy. In the late 1830s, he was already writing that the very idea of divine revelation was utterly incredible. He rejected the very idea of the biblical concept of miracles. He writes, "The more we know of the fixed laws of nature, the more incredible do miracles become." So that commitment to what he calls the fixed laws of nature preceded any of his scientific work and made it virtually inevitable that he was going to interpret the evidence through a naturalistic lens. And by the way, before we go on, of course, C.S. Lewis has given a wonderful rejoinder to that argument. He says, human beings can make things that nature itself would never create, right? You and I can build houses and tables, and we can produce things that nature itself cannot produce. But do we break a single law of nature? No, we never do. And so the fact that we have laws of nature does not mean that God cannot act. An intelligent agent, can act even when we have fixed laws of nature. So he was mistaken to think that because there are laws of nature, there cannot be any divine action in the world. But at any rate, that was his interpretation, that there are fixed laws of nature, and therefore we must come up with an origin of life that is completely naturalistic and that has no room for any kind of intelligent design.
Mm-hmm. So he was predisposed toward a naturalistic theory of evolution, even when he acknowledged his own theory was lacking in the evidence category. Well, unlike some modern Darwinists who claim that the theory is clearly supported by the facts, you remind us in your writing that Darwin himself knew that his theory was lacking and that it was grounded entirely on general considerations. So what does this tell us about his theory and how we should hold it today?
Yeah, you know, I do appreciate that about Darwin, is that he was not nearly as dogmatic as many of his followers, especially his followers today. You know, in that sense, he did show truly scientific attitude, because he was willing to say, for example, to really support the theory, he would have to show, if you're going to write a book called Origin of Species, you have to show the origin of a new species. And he specifically wrote that we cannot do that. When we descend to details, is how he put it, we cannot prove that a single species has changed. We cannot prove that the changes are beneficial, which is the whole groundwork of the theory. Those are his own words. And we cannot explain why some species have changed and others have not. In other words, he was quite aware that what he'd offered was more of an explanatory hypothesis rather than an actual theory. And I thought that was good that he did admit that. But as historians would say, like Neil Gillespie puts it this way, he says, but once you get rid of any notion that there's a divine agent in nature, then evolution is virtually the only conceivable means of species, this origin of species. So even secular historians will say that Darwin became an evolutionist only after he had become a naturalist, naturalism in the sense of a philosophical naturalist. And as Gillespie puts it, only later did he find the theory to validate his conviction. Hmm. So he started with a philosophical conviction and then started looking for a theory to validate it.
Hmm. An important distinction to keep in mind. Well, English biologist Thomas Huxley wasn't a great fan of Darwin's mechanism for evolution, yet he became known as Darwin's bulldog for his stubborn defense of the theory. So why did he so passionately promote a theory that he didn't hold to be scientifically sound?
Right, it's fascinating because, like I said earlier, in the earlier episode, he actually thought of evolution as being like embryonic development, which is not random changes and natural selection. You know, it's governed by an internal plan, a purpose, a structure. And that was his conception of evolution. And yet he was willing to become Darwin's bulldog. And why was that? Once again, it's because, as he puts it, even before he encountered Darwin's theory, he says, his words are, I had long done with Pentateuchal cosmogony. In other words, he'd given up any notion that there was a divine agent behind the universe. Mm-hmm. And he had looked at other theories of evolution, because there were others around before Darwin. Like I said in the first episode, most of them were some form of guided evolution, either God-guided or guided by some sort of life force. He had looked at those and hadn't seen any that he was really excited about. And yet, as he puts it, even though he had no scientific evidence, he said, I continued to nurse a pious conviction that evolution would turn out to be true. So I am fascinated by this religious language, you know, pious conviction.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is some of these people were so well known that family members would write about their recollections later. And Huxley's son, Leonard Huxley, said, what drew his father to Darwin's theory was that it gave him the philosophic unity he had been seeking. In other words, he was a naturalist already. This gave him a naturalistic theory of biology. What Huxley himself said was, it freed me from the dilemma of it's either God or nothing, because at that point there wasn't any satisfactory naturalistic theory. So if it's God or nothing, and you're already a naturalist, you're going to go with a naturalistic theory. And that's how he put it. It was, if you don't believe in a divine agent, it's either Darwin or nothing. So I'm going to go with Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's as if they found themselves with no choice. Once they committed to a naturalistic philosophy of life, there was no other option to explain the history of life on Earth. Is that accurate?
Yeah. There's a historian named Peter Bowler who calls Huxley a pseudo-Darwinian, which is an interesting phrase. He was a pseudo-Darwinian, by which he means he rallied Darwin for philosophic reasons even though he was not convinced of Darwin's scientific theory. As he puts it, Huxley was guaranteed to support Darwin because of his empiricist philosophy. In other words, empiricism, naturalism, he's kind of using those synonymously. But the point is, he was guaranteed to support it because of his philosophy, even though he didn't agree with it scientifically. So he was a pseudo-Darwinian.
Huh. Well, very interesting. In our next segment, Nancy looks at one of the most important strategies Darwin and his supporters used in order to discredit the design hypothesis. As the battle became more heated, they sought to make design implausible by casting it as perpetual miracle. In so doing, they set up a straw man that continues to be useful to modern-day Darwinists. We hope you'll join us to continue this interesting conversation about whether or not the design argument was really conquered in the 19th century. Nancy, thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to read more of Nancy's writing on science, you can pick up a copy of her book, The Soul of Science. And to explore some of the social and moral implications of Darwinism, check out her latest book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. Get all the info you need at our website, nancypiercy.com. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.